knew how long, decayed to a waterfall of spiderous threads. Corroded swords were bolted to corroded panels on the wall. Through a window, somewhere high up, the sunbeams poured down dust in golden torrents. Gideon would have dearly loved this training room in its prime, but she wouldn't touch those rusted blades now if you paid her. Going back to the vestibule with the spitting lights, she noticed another door set close to the staircase. She hadn't seen it before because a tapestry covered it almost entirely, but one of the corners had slipped and hinted at the frame beneath. She pushed the mouldering old tapestry aside to find a dark wooden door. She tried its handle, pulled it open, and stared. A long tiled corridor stared back, windowless, a succession of square lights in the ceiling whirring to life with a clunk, 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 and tracing a path to an enormous door at the other end, totally out of place, bracketed by heavy pillars set with forbidding stone supports. The overall effect was not exactly welcoming. The door itself was a crossbar of black stone set in a beveled frame of the same. A weird relief was carved above the lintel, set within a moulded panel. Gideon's boots echoed down the shiny stone tiles as she came closer to see. The relief was five little circles joined with lines, in no pattern that Gideon recognised. Below this sat a solid stone beam with carved leaves swagged horizontally from one end to the other. At the apex of each swag was carved an animal skull with long horns which curved inward into wicked points that almost met. Slim columns reached up to support this weird stone bunting, and wound around each column was something carved to seem writhing and alive, a fat, slithering thing, bulging and animal. Gideon reached out to touch the intricately carved marble and felt tiny, overlapping scales touched the seam where its ridged underbelly met its back. It was very cold. There was no handle, no knocker, no knob, just a dark keyhole for teeth that would have been as long as Gideon's thumb. She peered through the keyhole and saw jack shit. Suffice to say, all pushing, gripping, finger-inserting and pressing was in vain. It was locked as damn. Curious, thought Gideon. She went back to the claustrophobic little vestibule and, out of a complete sense of perversity, tacked the tapestry back up so that the door was totally covered. In the shadows, the effect was very good. Nobody'd be finding that one any time soon. It was a stupid, secretive ninth thing to do, done out of habit, and Gideon hated how comforting it felt. Voices were fading into the edge of her hearing from the top of the landing that led to the stairs. Another ninth instinct had Gideon flatten herself back into the bottom of the stairwell. Done a million times before to avoid the Marshal of Dreaber, or Harrowhark, or one of the god-awful great-aunts or members of the locked tomb cloister. Gideon had no idea whom she was avoiding, but she avoided them anyway because it was such an easy thing to do. A conversation conducted in low, rich, peevish tones drifted down. "Mystical oblique claptrap," someone was saying, "and I have half a mind to write to your father and complain." "What?" drawled another. "That the first house isn't treating us fairly. A lateral puzzle isn't a trial. And now that I think about it, the idea that the old fogey doesn't know a thing about it is beyond belief. Some geriatric playing mind games, or worse. And this is my theory. Wanting to see who breaks..."
"Ever the conspiracy theorist," said the second voice.
The first voice was aggrieved. "Why are the shuttles gone? Why is this place such a tip? Why the secrecy? Why is the food so bad? QED, it's a conspiracy."
There was a thoughtful pause.
"I didn't think the food was that bad," said a third voice.
I'll tell you what it is, continued the first voice. It's a cheap, cohort-style enlisted man's hazing. They're waiting to see who's stupid enough to take the bait, who falls for it, you see. Well, I shan't. Unless, said the second voice, which now that Gideon was hearing it, was very like the third voice in pitch and tone, differentiated only by affect. The challenge is one of protocol. We have to provide a valid response to a necessarily vague question in order to authenticate ourselves, making meaning from the meaningless, etc. The first voice had taken on a tinge of a whine when it said, Oh, for God's sake! Scuffle. Movement. The stairs echoed with footsteps. They were coming down. I do wonder where that funny old man hid the shuttles, mused the third voice. The second, drop them off the side of the dock, I expect. Don't be mad, said the first. Those things cost a fortune. At the bottom of the stairs, deep in the shadows, Gideon got her first good glimpse of the speakers. The strange twin scions of the third house were looking around, attended to by their sulky, slightly bouffant cavalier. Up close, Gideon was more impressed than ever. The golden third twin was probably the best-looking person she'd ever seen in her life. She was tall and regal, with some radiant butterfly quality. Her shirt was haphazardly tucked into her trousers, which were haphazardly tucked into her boots, but she was all topaz and shine and luster. Necromancers affected robes in the same way cavaliers affected swords, but she hadn't tucked her arms into hers, and it was a gauzy, gold-shot, transparent thing floating out around her like wings. There were about 5 rings on each hand, and her earrings would have put chandeliers to shame. But she had an air of wild and innocent over-decoration, of having put on the prettiest things in her jewellery box and then forgotten to take them off. Her buttery hair was stuck to her forehead with sweat, and she kept tangling a curl of it in one finger and artlessly letting it go. The second twin was as though the first had been taken to pieces and put back together without any genius. She wore a robe of the same cloth and colour, but on her it was a beautiful shroud on a mummy. The cavalier had lots of hair, an aquiline face, and a self-satisfied little jacket. "I think," the bright twin was saying, "that it's a hell of a lot better than sticking us in a room and playing Who's the Best Necromancer? Or worse, loading us up with old scrolls and having us translate rituals for hours and hours on end." "Yes, it would have been unfortunate," agreed her sister placidly, "considering it would have demonstrated within the first 5 minutes that you're completely thick." A curl was wound about one finger. "Oh, shut it, Ianthe. We should be celebrating if we're being honest with ourselves," the pallid girl continued, warming to her subject, "since the already poorly hidden fact of you being a great big bimbo would have come to light so quickly that it would have broken the sound barrier." The curl was let go with a visual sprawling. "Ianthe, don't make me cross." "Please don't be cross," said her sister. "You know your brain can only deal with one emotion at a time." Their cavalier's expression got ugly. "You're sorry, Anthe," he said sharply. "You can't show off with books ad infinitum, and so you're invisible, isn't that it?" Both girls rounded on him at once. The pallid twin simply stared, eyes closed to pale-lashed slits, but the lovely twin took one of his ears between a thumb and forefinger and tweaked it unmercifully. He was not a short young man, but she had half a head on him, and a whole head if you counted her hair. Her sister watched from the side, impassive, though Gideon swore that she was smiling, very slightly. "If you talk like that to her again, Babs," said the golden twin, "I'll destroy you. Beg her forgiveness." He was shocked and defensive.
Come on, you know I didn't. That was for you. I was meeting the insult for you.
She can insult me as she likes. You're insubordinate. Say you're sorry.
Princess, I live to serve
Naberius, she said, and pulled his ear forward so that he had to come with it, like an animal being led by a bit. Two bright red spots of outrage had formed in his cheeks. The lovely twin waggled his ear gently so that his head shook with it.
Grovel, Babs, as soon as possible, please.
Leave it, Corona, said the other girl suddenly. This isn't the time to horse around. Drop him, and let's keep going.
The bright twin, Corona, hesitated, but then dropped the ear of the unfortunate cavalier. He rubbed it fretfully. Gideon could only see the back of his head, but he kept looking at the girl who'd basically clouted him like a whipped dog, the arrogant line of his head and shoulders drooping. Suddenly, impetuously, Corona slung one arm around him and perambulated forward, giving his other ear a tweak. He jerked sullenly away before wheeling him through the doors to the pit room. The pale twin held the door open for them both. As they went through, exclaiming at the smell, the pale twin paused. She did not follow them. She looked straight into the darkness instead, the deep shadows around the stairwell. Gideon knew that she was completely hidden, hooded, invisible, but she felt herself pressing backward anyway, away from that pale, washed-out gaze which was staring with discomforting accuracy straight at her.
"This is not a clever path to start down," she said softly. "I would not attract attention from the necromancer of the third house."
The pale twin stepped through and closed the door behind her. Gideon was left alone.
Chapter 10
Harrowhark did not appear for a midday meal. Gideon, still unused to the concept of midday meal, or honestly midday, appeared a good hour earlier than anyone else would have. Either everyone had an appropriate circadian pattern of hunger, or they were being too housely and well-bred not to follow one. Gideon sat in the hot, scrubbed room where she had eaten breakfast and was given a meal of pallid white meat and a bunch of leaves. It was good that she was alone. She had no clue what to do with it. She ate the meat with a fork. You didn't need a knife. It was so tender that it flaked away if you touched it, and ate the leaves one by one with her fingers. She realized partway through that it was probably a salad. Raw vegetables in the ninth came in the form of pitiable cairns of grated snow leek, strained through with as much salty black sauce as it would absorb. She filled up on the bread, which was really very good, and stuck a piece in her robe for later. A skeleton had brought her food. A skeleton had taken it away, with the same pinpoint accuracy the others had shown. There were no cheap tricks with them, she noticed. Nobody had jammed pins through the joints so that they'd stick together easier, or slabbed on big gobs of tendon. No, whoever had raised them had been extraordinarily talented. She suspected it was Teacher. Hero wouldn't like that. The House of the Ninth was meant to have cornered the market on perfect reconstruction, and here were a whole bunch of them probably made by a little man who clapped his hands together unironically. Just as Gideon had shaken the crumbs off her lap and was rising to leave, two more novitiates entered. When they saw Gideon, both they and she stopped dead. One of the pair was a wan, knife-faced kid dressed in antiseptic whites and chainmail you could cut with a fork, it was so delicate. He was draped in it even down to a kilt, which was strange. Necromancers didn't normally wear that type of armor, and he was definitely the necromancer. He had a necromancer build. Pale silk fluttered from his slim shoulders.
He gave the impression of being the guy fun sort out for death. He was prim and ascetic-looking, and his companion, who was older, a fair bit older than Gideon herself, had the air of the perpetually disgruntled. He was rather more robust, nuggety, and dressed in chipped, bleached leathers that looked as though they'd seen genuine use. At least one finger on his left hand was a gross-looking stump, which she admired. The reason why they had stopped dead was unclear. She had stopped dead because the necromancer was staring at her with an expression of naked hostility. He looked at her as though he had finally come face to face with the murderer of a beloved family pet. Gideon had spent too long in the depths of Dreaber not to know when to, put scientifically, get outy. It was not the first time she had received that look. Sister Lacrimorta had looked at her that way almost exclusively, and Sister Lacrimorta was blind. The only difference in the way that Crux had looked at her was that Crux had managed also to encapsulate a complete lack of surprise, as though she already had managed to disappoint his lowest expectations. And a very long time ago, painfully folded in the back of her amygdala, the Reverend Mother and the Reverend Father had also looked at her like that, though in their case their diffidence had been cut through with a phobic flinch, the way you'd look at an unexpected maggot.
"Please deal with the shadow cultist," said the wave-faced boy, who had the deepest, weariest, most repressive voice she had ever heard in her life.
"Yes, uncle," said the bigger man. Gideon was raw for a fight. She wanted nothing more than for the cross-faced man in boiled leather to draw on her. He was strong-boned and weathered, deeply creased, yellow-brown and yellow-coarse all over. Next to his almost daintily dressed necromancer in white, he looked dusty and ferocious. He looked tough. Thank God. She wanted to fight bloody. She wanted to fight until bone adepts had to be called to put people's feet back on. She knew the price. Waking up mummified in aggressive notes, or maybe dying, but didn't care any more. Gideon was measuring in her mind's eye the length of her rapier to the collarbones of the cavalier opposite. He disappointed her viscerally by standing a few steps away, putting his hands together and bowing over them to her. It was polite, though not apologetic. He had a lighter, rougher voice than his necromancer, somewhat hoarse, like he suffered from a lifelong cold or a smoker's cough.
"My uncle can't eat with your kind around," he said. "Please leave."
Gideon had a million questions, like, "Your kind?" and, "Why do you have such a baby uncle, one the colour of mayonnaise?" and, "Is your kind people who aren't nephews and who have middle fingers?" But she said nothing. She stared him down for a few seconds. He stared back. His face did not hold the same brand of hate, but it held a bullish, deadened expression that seemed to go right through her. If it had been Crux, she would have given him the finger. As it was, she nodded and pushed past with her mind in an indignant whirl. Gideon felt awfully suckered by the whole thing. She had longed for the cohort, in part due to being heartily sick of her time alone in the dark. She'd wanted to be a part of something bigger than encroaching dementia and snow leak husbandry. What was she now? An unwelcome spectre roaming the halls without a necro to pursue? The stinging slap in the face that she didn't even have Harrow, still alone, just in better lighting? She had cherished the tiny delusion that the Lictor trials would see her being useful for more than spying on conversations and spoiling breakfasts. Even swords, too, would have been a sweet reprieve from idleness. It was in this frame of mind, reckless with disappointment, that she pushed her way at random through a collection of dark, empty antechambers and up a flight of damp brick steps, and then suddenly she found herself outside, in a terraced garden. The sun blazed down through a canopy of glass or some thick transparent plex. It was, admittedly, a garden only in a very sad sense of the word. Wherever the first house grew its food leaves, they didn't grow them here. The salt was thick on each metal strut. The planters were full of shrubby, stunted green things with long stems and drooping blossoms, bleached from the thick white light overhead. Weird fragrances rose like heat above them. Heavy smells, strange smells. Nothing that grew on the ninth had a real scent. Not the moss and spores in its caves, and not the dried-out vegetables cultivated in its fields. The plex ended in a genuinely open area where the wind ruffled the wrinkled leaves of some wrinkled old trees, and there, under an awning in the undulating sun, looking like a long-stemmed drooping blossom herself, was Dulcinea. She was entirely alone. Her man-hulk was nowhere to be seen. Lying in a chair, she looked flimsy and tired. Fine lines marked the corners of the eyes and the mouth, and she was wearing a fashionable and inane hat. She was dressed in something light and clingy that she had not yet hawked blood upon. It looked as though she was sleeping, and Gideon, not for the first time, felt a spike of pity. She tried to backtrack, but it was too late. "Don't go," said the figure, her eyes fluttering open. "Thought so. Hello, Gideon the Ninth. Can you come and put this chair's back up straight for me? I'd do it myself, but you know by now that I'm not well, and some days I don't feel entirely up to it. Can I beg you that favour?"
There was a fine sheen of sweat on the translucent brow under the frivolous hat, and a certain shortness of breath. Gideon went to the chair and fiddled with the fastening, immediately emasculated by the difficulty of working out a simple chair latch. The Lady Septimus waited passively for Gideon to pull it flush, smiling at her with those big, gentian eyes.
"Thank you," she said, once she had been propped up.
She took the silly hat off her damp, fawn-coloured curls and set it in her lap, and her expression was somewhat conspiratorial.
"I know that you're doing penance and can't talk, so you don't have to figure out how to tell me through charades."
Gideon's eyebrows shot up over her sunglasses' rims before she could stop them.
"Oh, yes," said the girl, dimpling. "You're not the first ninth nun I've ever met. I've often thought it must be so hard being a brother or sister of the locked tomb. I actually dreamed of being one when I was young. It seemed such a romantic way to die. I must have been about 13. You see, I knew I was going to die then. I didn't want anyone to look at me, and the ninth house was so far away. I thought I could just have some time to myself and then expire very beautifully alone in a black robe with everyone praying over me and being solemn. But then I found out about the face paint you all have to wear," she added fretfully, "and that wasn't my aesthetic. You can't drape yourself over your cell and fade away beautifully in face paint. Does this count as a conversation? Am I breaking your penance? Shake for no and nod for yes." "Good,"
she said, when Gideon mutely shook her head no, sucked completely under this mad, bubbling riptide.
"I love a captive listener. I know you're only doing this because you feel bad for me, and you do look like a nice kid. Sorry," she added hastily, "you're not a child, but I feel so old right now. Did you see the pair from the fourth house? Babies. They have contributed to me feeling ancient. Tomorrow I might feel useful, but today's a bad day, and I feel like a gimp. Take off your glasses, please, Gideon the Ninth. I'd like to see your eyes."
At the juxtaposition of Gideon with obedient, Many people would have rocked with laughter and gone on chuckling and gurgling for quite some time. But she was helpless now in the face of this extraordinary request. She was helpless at the thin arms and rosebud smile of the woman girl in front of her. She was utterly helpless at the word gimp. She slid her sunglasses off her nose and obligingly presented her face for inspection. And she was inspected, thoroughly and immediately. The eyes narrowed with intent, and for a moment the face was all business. There was something swift and cool in the blueness of those eyes, some deep intelligence, some sheer, shameless depth and breadth of looking. It made Gideon's cheeks flare, despite her mental reproach to, "Slow down, Nav, slow down." "Oh, singular," said Dulcinea quietly, more to herself than to Gideon. "Hypochrome, recessive." "I like looking at people's eyes," she explained suddenly, smiling now. "They tell you such a lot. I couldn't tell you much about your reverend daughter, but you have eyes like gold coins. Am I embarrassing you? Am I being a creep?" At the headshake, no. She settled back more into her chair, tilting her head to the seat back and fanning herself with the frivolous hat. "Good," she said with satisfaction. "It's bad enough that we're stuck in this burnt-out old hovel without me scaring you. Isn't it fantastically abandoned? Imagine all the ghosts of everyone who must have lived here, worked here, still waiting to be called, if we could figure out how. The Seventh doesn't do well with ghosts, you know. We offend them. We're worrisome. The old division between body and spirit. We deal too much with the body, crystallizing it in time, trapping it unnaturally. The opposite of your house, don't you think, Gideon the Ninth? You take empty things and build with them. We press down the hand of a clock to try to stop it from ticking the last second." This was all so far over Gideon's head that it sat somewhere out in space. But there was something soothing about it anyway. Gideon had only ever been clotheslined this way with Heruhark, who explained herself seldom, and as you would only to a very stupid child. Dulcinea had the dreamy, confiding manner of someone who, despite spouting grade-A horseshit, was confident you would understand everything she was saying. Also, as she talked, she smiled widely and prettily and moved her lashes up and down. Thus hypnotized, Gideon could only watch with a mouthful of teeth as the blue-eyed necromancer laid one slight, narrow hand on her arm. Her skin stretched thin over very marked metacarpals and wrist bones like knots in a rope.
"Stand up for me," said Dulcinea. "Indulge me. Lots of people do, but I want you to."
Gideon pulled away and stood. The sunlight dappled over the hem of her robe in rusty splotches. Dulcinea said,
"Draw your sword, Gideon of the Ninth."
Grasping the smooth black grip beneath the black nest of the knuckle bow, Gideon drew. It seemed as though she had drawn this damn thing 1,000 times, that Iglamine's voice had taken permanent residence in her head now, just to keep up the charade.
"Draw. Lean on the right foot. Arm bent, not collapsed. Naked blade angled at your opponent's face or chest. You're guarding the outer side of your body, Nav. You're on your right foot, and you're not waiting forward like a goddamned piece of freight. You're centered. You can move backward or forward at will."
The rapier blade, away from its black home in Dreerbur, burned a lightless, opaque metal colour, a long, slender absence of hue. Gideon acknowledged its beauty grudgingly, how it looked like a needle, an ebon ribbon.
Off hand, up and high.
She relaxed into position, triumphant in the new body memory that her teacher had beaten into her and wanted to fight again.
Oh, very good, said Dulcinea, and she clapped like a child seeing a firework. Perfect, just like a picture of Nonius. People say that all Ninth Cavaliers are good for is pulling around baskets of bones. Before I met you, I imagined that you might be some wizened thing with a yoke and panniers of cartilage, half-skeleton already.
This was bigoted, assumptive, and completely true. Gideon relaxed her sword and her stance at her ease, and saw that the fragile girl engulfed by her chair had stopped playing with her frivolous hat. Her mouth was quirked in a quizzical little smile, and her eyes said that she had calculated 2 plus 2 and ended up with a very final 4.
"Gideon the Ninth," said Dulcinea slowly. "Are you used to a heavier sword?"
Gideon looked down. She looked at her rapier, pointed skyward like a black arrow, her offhand cupped and supporting what should have been more grip but now was the long knob of pommel, the way you'd hold a fucking longsword. She sheathed it immediately, sliding it home to its scabbard in a tight iron whisper. A cold sweat had broken out beneath her clothes. The expression on Dulcinea's face was simply bright-eyed, mischievous interest. But to Gideon, it was the secondarius bell chiding a child already 10 minutes late for prayer. For a moment, a lot of stupid stuff felt very ready to happen. She nearly confessed everything to Dulcinea's mild and denim-coloured gaze. She nearly opened her mouth and begged wholeheartedly for the woman's mercy. It was in this moment of charged stupidity that Protesilaus turned up, saving her bacon by dint of being very large and ignoring her. He stood with his muddy hair and bleary skin and blocked the shaft of sunlight that was pattering over his adept's hands, and he said to her in his dreary, rumbling voice, "It's shut." No time to figure out that one. As Dulcinea's eyes flickered between her cavalier and the cavalier of the Ninth, Gideon took the opportunity to turn tail and, not run, but slope extremely fast in the direction of anywhere but there. There were cracks in the plex, and the wind was coming in hot and salty, rippling her robes and her hood. And she had nearly escaped when Dulcinea called, "Gideon the Ninth!" She half-turned her head back to them, dark glasses crooking down over her eyebrows. Protesilaus the Seventh stared at her with the empty eyes of someone who would watch with equal heavy disinterest if part of the wall were kicked out and she were punted down into the sea. But his adept was looking at her, wistfully. Gideon hesitated by the door for that look, in the shadows of the archway, buffeted by the wind from the water. Dulcinea said,
"I hope we talk again soon."
Hell, thought Gideon, taking the stairs blindly 2 at a time. She didn't. She had said too much already, and all without speaking a single word.
Chapter 11. Those early days at Canaan House spaced themselves out like beads on a prayer string, dilated. They consisted of big, empty hours, of eating meals in unoccupied rooms, of being alone amid very strange strangers. Gideon couldn't even rely on the familiarity of the dead. The skeletons of the first were too good, too capable, too watchful, and Gideon didn't feel truly at her ease anywhere except shut up in the dim rooms that the Ninth had been given, doing drills. After nearly giving everything away, she spent 2 days almost entirely cloistered, working with her rapier until the sweat had smeared her face paint to a leering, staved-in mask. She stacked a rusting stool on top of the sagging ebon dresser and did chin-ups into the iron wedge that ran across the rafters. She did press-ups in front of the windows until Dominicus limbed her with bloody light, completing its sprint around the watery planet. Both nights she went to bed sore and furious with loneliness. Crux always had said that she was at her most unbearable after confinement. She fell into a deep, black sleep and woke up only once, the second night, when, in the very early morning, when the night outside seemed more like the lightless ninth, Harahark Nonagesimus shut the door behind herself very nearly silently. She kept her eyes mostly closed as the reverend daughter paused before the makeshift bed, and as she watched, the robed black figure drifted over to the bedroom. Then there was no more noise, and Harrow was gone again in the morning when Gideon awoke. She didn't even leave rude notes. It was in this abandoned state that the cavalier of the ninth house ate two breakfasts, starved of both protein and attention, dark glasses slipping on her nose as she drank another bowl of soup. She would have killed to see a couple of haggard nuns tottering around the place, and was therefore 100% vulnerable when she looked up to see a third house twin stride into the room like a lion. It was the lovely one. She had the sleeves of her gauzy robe haphazardly rolled up to each golden shoulder, and her hair tied back in a tawny cloud, and she looked at Gideon with an expression like an artillery shell mid-flight. "The ninth," she said. She sauntered over. Gideon had risen to stand, remembering the pale eyes of her pissed-off twin, but instead found a beringed hand proffered in her direction. "Lady Coronabeth Tridentarius," she was told, "Princess of Ida, heir of the Third House." Gideon did not know what to do with the hand, which was offered to her fingers out, palm upward. She touched her fingers to it in the hope that she could grip it briefly and get out that way. But Coronabeth Tridentarius, Princess of Ida, took her hand and roguishly kissed the backs of Gideon's knuckles. Her smile was sparklingly pleased with her own gall. Her eyes were a deep, liquid violet, and she spoke with the casual effrontery of someone who expected her every command of jump to be followed by a rave. "I've organized sparring matches for the cavaliers of all the houses," she said. "It's my hope that even the ninth will accept my invitation. Will it?" If Gideon had not been so lonely, if Gideon had not been so used to having a fighting partner, even one more used these days to battling rheumatism, if Coronabeth Tridentarius had not been so astonishingly hot, all these ifs she contemplated wearily, led by the third house necromancer down the pokey, confined little staircase immediately familiar to her as the one she'd explored before, down to the dark, tiled vestibule with the flickering lights, and through to the room with a foul-smelling chemical pit. This room was now alive with activity. There were three skeletons down in the pit with hairy mops and buckets, cleaning the slime out of it. A fourth was wiping down the streaked glass double doors through to the mirror room beyond. The fug of rot was overlaid with the equally pervasive fug of surfactants and wood polish. Old age still had the place in a chokehold, but in the hot light of the early morning, two figures danced around each other on the outspread flagstone dais of the mirror room. The urgent metal scrape of sword on sword filled the space up to the rafters. A skeleton in the corner wound a long pole into a network of cobwebs, displacing showers of dust. A couple of others sat about, watching the fight. The cavalier of the third she recognized even without his smug little jacket, which he had hung over a peg as he struck a fatigued attitude to clean his sword. She could not mistake the cavalier of the second in her intense cohort officer whites, contrasted with a jacket of blazing red. She was watching the two in the center. Facing each other on the flagstones, swords and long knives throwing up beveled yellow reflections on the walls,
were Magnus and the abominable girl teen, stripped down to their shirt sleeves. Everyone looked up as the Princess of Ida glowed into sight, because you couldn't do anything else. "Sir Magnus, behold my coup," she said, and she gestured to Gideon. This did not produce a susurrus of respectful murmurs, as she had obviously hoped. The dress-uniform cavalier stood to attention, but her gaze was blank and cool. The fourth girl dropped form and rocked backward on her heels, whistling noisily in fascinated horror. The cavalier of the third raised his eyebrows and took on an expression of dismay, as though his necromancer had just presented them with a leper. Only Magnus gave her a genial, if slightly bewildered, smile.
"Princess Corona, trust you to nab Gideon the Ninth," he said, and to his dreadful teen, "See, now you can have a duel with someone else and not bore everyone by how soundly Jean-Marie the Fourth can thrash me."
"No, Magnus, don't mention me," hissed that dreadful teen.
"I'd be ashamed to admit to that," said the third cavalier significantly.
The unfortunate Jean-Marie the Fourth was going red in the face. She drew herself up to say something obviously unwise, but her sparring partner clapped her on the back with an unsinkable smile.
"Ashamed, Prince Nabirius, to lose to a chatter," he said heartily. "Goodness me, no. Cavalier family since the time of the resurrection should feel ashamed if she lost to me. I've known her since she was a child. She knows I'm absolutely no good. You should have seen her when she was 5.
"Magnus, do not talk about me being 5.
Now, let me tell you this story."
"Magnus, do not tell anyone this story."
"Challenged me to a duel during a reception. Said I'd insulted her. Think it was a matter of propping her up with cushions. And to be honest, she would have had me if she hadn't been using a bread knife as her offhand."
Disgusted beyond all tolerance, the much-tried Jean-Marie let out a primal yell and escaped to the benches on the other side of the room, far away from them. Now that she wasn't looking, Magnus gave Nabirius a look of frank reproof. The third's cavalier coloured and looked away.
"I want to see a match," said Princess Corona. "Come, Gideon, the Ninth, right? Why don't you try Sir Magnus instead? Don't believe it when he says he's rubbish. The Fifth House is meant to turn out very fine cavaliers."
Magnus inclined his head.
"Of course I'm willing, and the princess is gracious," he said. "But I didn't get to be cavalier primary due to being the best with a rapier. I'm cavalier primary only because my adept is also my wife. I suppose you could say that I... cavalier primaried."
From the other side of the room, Jean-Marie let out a long noise like a death rattle. Princess Corona laughed outright. Magnus looked extremely pleased with himself. The faces of the other two were patiently blank. Gideon made a mental note to write down the joke so that she could use it herself later. Corona inclined her bright head in toward Gideon. She smelled nice, like how Gideon imagined soap was meant to smell.
"Will the Ninth honour us?" she murmured prettily.
Stronger women than Gideon could not have said no to an up-close and personal Corona Tridentarius. She stepped up to the dais, her boots ringing out on the stone. The older man opposite's eyes widened when he saw that she was not going to take off her robe, nor her hood, nor her glasses. The air in the room thrilled, all except for the dreary scrape, scrape, scrape of the skeleton removing cobwebs. Even Jean-Marie sat up from her posture of premature death to watch. There was a low murmur of amazement from Corona when Gideon twitched open her robe to reveal the knuckles latched to her belt. They glittered blackly in the sunlight as she slipped them onto her hand.
"Knuckle knives," said the third's cavalier in outright disbelief. "The Ninth uses knuckle knives. Not traditionally."
That was the cavalier in the cohort uniform, who had a voice as crisp as her collar. Nabirius said with forced languor,
I simply can't remember ever thinking knuckle knives were a viable option.
They're tremendously nasty. Gideon admitted to herself that the way Corona said it was kind of hot. Nibiria sniffed.
They're a brawler's weapon.
The cohort cav said,
Well, we'll see.
That was the strange thing about keeping mute, thought Gideon. Everyone seemed to talk at you rather than to you. Only her erstwhile sparring partner was looking her dead in the eye, as much as he could through dark glasses anyway.
Does the ninth,
Magnus was gesturing in a rather general way to Gideon's robes, her glasses, her hood, which he translated to, Are you going to take those off? When she shook her head no, he shrugged in wonder.
All right,
and added the slightly bewildering,
Well done.
Corona said, I'll arbitrate, and they moved into position. Once again, Gideon was back down in the half-lit depths of Dreaba, in the cement-poured tomb of a soldier's hall. Cavalier duels worked the same way Iglamine had taught her they would, which was very much the same way they did back home, just with more folderol. You stood in front of each other and laid your offhand arm across your chest, showing which man-gauche weapon you intended to use. Her knuckle knives were laid fat and black against her collarbone. Magnus's sword, a beautiful dagger of ivory-coloured steel, the handle a twist of creamy leather, touched his.
To the first touch,
said the arbiter, badly hiding her rising excitement.
Clavicle to sacrum, arms exception. Cool.
First touch? In Dreaba, it was to the floor, but there was no time to contemplate that one. Magnus was smiling at her with the boyish, teacherly enthusiasm of a man about to play a ball game with a younger sibling. But beneath that excellent mask, there was a note of doubt about his eyes, a tugging of his mouth, and something in Gideon rose as well. He was a little afraid of her.
Magnus the Fifth, he said, and, go easy.
Gideon looked over at Corona and shook her head. The necromancer princess of Ida was too well-bred to query and too quick to mistake, and simply said,
I call for Gideon the Ninth. 7 paces back. Turn. Begin.
There were 4 pairs of hungry eyes watching that fight, but they all blurred into the background of a dream, the lines one's brain filled in to abbreviate a place, a time, a memory. Gideon Nav knew in the first half-second that Magnus was going to lose. After that, she stopped thinking with her brain and started thinking with her arms, which were, frankly, where the best of her cerebral matter lay. What happened next was like closing your eyes in a warm and stuffy room. The first faint from the fifth house was the heavy drowsiness that filled the back of her head all the way down to her toes. The second, the weightless loll of the skull to the chest. Gideon tucked her offhand behind her back, said to herself, Stop blocking every blow, and did not even bother to parry. She pivoted away each syrup slow thrust without meeting it, bent back from the follow-up with the dagger like they had agreed beforehand where it would fall. He pressed his quarter, trying to force her, and she very gently folded his sword to the side with hers, contraparried. The point of her black rapier flickered like paper touched with a flame and came to rest a quarter inch away from his heart, making him stutter to a halt. She bumped the tip of her sword into his chest, very gently. It was over in 3 moves. A mental haptic jolt bunted Gideon awake, and there she was, rapier held still to Magnus's chest. Magnus, with the good-natured but poleaxed expression of a man caught mid-practical joke, 4 sets of staring, equally blank expressions. Their very good-looking arbiter's mouth was even hanging very slightly open, lips parting over white teeth, gaping dumbly until she caught up.
Match to the 9th. Goodness me, said Magnus.
The room let out a collective breath. Jean-Marie said,
Oh, my days!
And the cohort cav of the second sat up at least 2 inches taller than before, thumb pressed furiously hard into the soft part under her chin in thought. Gideon was busy sheathing her sword a heartbeat after Magnus had sheathed his, jerky with lag time in returning his bow, turning away. Her sweat had turned to adrenaline. Her adrenaline was singing through her as fine, hot fuel, but her brain and heart had not caught up with the result. The only emotion she was feeling was a slow-to-saturate relief. She had won. She had won, even though moving in a robe and dark glasses was so stupid. Iglamine's honour could go another day intact, and Gideon's ass could go spiritually unkicked. Conversations were happening around her, not to her. A bit plaintively, "I'm not quite that out of form, am I?"
"Magnus! Magnus! 3 moves, Magnus!
Am I getting old? Should Abigail and I divorce?"
I didn't even see her move. Corona was breathing hard. God, she's fast. Because they were in closest proximity, her first gaze after the fight fell on the over-groomed cavalier of the third, Nibirius. His eyes were taut, and his smile was unnerved. His eyes were blue, but this close, she could see that they were stained through in places with a light, insipid brown that made Gideon think of oily water.
"Next match to me," said Nibirius.
"Don't be greedy," said his princess, good-naturedly and a trifle distractedly. "The ninth just fought. Why don't you go toe-to-toe with Jean-Marie?" But it was clear that he did not want to go toe-to-toe with Jean-Marie, and, judging by the look on her face, she was no keener on the idea. Nibirius shrugged his shoulders back, rolling up the sleeves of his fine cotton shirt to each elbow. He did not drop his gaze from Gideon.
"You didn't even break a sweat, did you?" he said. "No, you're ready to go again. Try me."
"Oh, Babs, come on." His voice was much softer, more coaxing and appealing when he was speaking to Corona.
"Let the third show what it can do, my lady. I know you'd rather watch your own."
There was a peculiarly nasal lilt to his voice, a sort of posh, elongated vowel that made it rather.
"Put me in. Dias can get another look at me."
Next to him, the cohort cavalier, who was obviously height Dias, raised her eyebrows the exact 1/8 of an inch to indicate how much she wanted to get another look at him.
"The ninth?"
Gideon's heart was still ricocheting around her chest. She raised her shoulders in an expression that the brethren of the locked tomb would have recognized immediately as the precursor of Gideon about to do something particularly daft, but Corona took it as acceptance and said mock-indulgently to her calf,
"Well then, my dear, go off and make yourself happy."
He beamed as though he had just been bought a new pair of shoes. Gideon thought, "Shit." The cohort cavalier, Dias, was saying,
"Your Highness, the adept shouldn't officiate for their cavalier."
"Oh, pff, surely just this once can't harm, Lieutenant."
"You can't call yourself a disinterested arbitrator, Princess," Magnus was saying.
"Nonsense. I'm harder on him than anyone else. To the touch. Call."
In a very short space of time, she was standing face to face with another cavalier, and there was a juddering in her ears that she recognized as the beating of her own heart. The glass of her knuckle knives felt black and cold and silky all the way through a layer of robe and her shirt, and her tongue felt thick in her mouth. She hadn't been this overstimulated since that one time when training had consisted of crux, a repeating crossbow, and 2 skeletons with machetes. The third's main-gauche dagger was as gorgeously wrought as his hair, chased silver and imperial violet, the arms of the hilt curved and hugging inward in a way that tugged on her memory but did not grasp the right file. The blade was thin and bright and flared at the top. She was so busy looking at it that she barely heard Nibirius say,
"Nibirius the third,"
and very, very quietly, just for her,
Ninth calves and necro suitcases. Who are you?
It was good that she had already practiced how to be quiet, because the traditional Nav response would have been one of any number of pieces of crude backchat. She resented the contempt with which his mouth rounded over Ninth. She resented suitcases. She resented his hair. But Coronabeth was singing out, "I call for Gideon the Ninth," and they were marking 5 paces, 6, 7. She had only a moment to size Nibirius up. He was about an inch shorter than her, with a frame that had been whipped within an inch of its life into perfectly sculpted muscle. He was narrow-shouldered with long, long arms, and she was beginning to believe that he was not simply a douchebag who used lip balm, but a douchebag who used lip balm and had a very long reach. He stood perfectly, more perfectly even than her teacher, who had partially fused her spine with standing to attention. His rapier was a froth of silver wire and tracery at the loop of the hilt, and the blade shone notchless, perfect as the line made from his shoulder to its tip. Her answering stance felt slouchy and half-assed, and the black knuckle knives brutish, unsurgical. The hard moo of his mouth told her that he was used to making people feel that way, but also that he definitely used lip balm. Her heart sped up, slowed, renewed, arrhythmic with anticipation. "Begin," called Corona. In the first 10 seconds, Gideon had known that the fight with the fifth house was hers to lose. It took her 20 seconds to come to a very important discovery about the house of the third. It valued cleanliness. Each twitch of the sword was a masterpiece of technique. He fought like clockwork, inevitable, bloodless, perfect, with absolute economy of movement. The first time the black sword of the Ninth flicked into action, the line of his rapier slicing hers to the side, a simple semicircle arc with the blade bored, contemptuous, exact, would have brought an expert to tears. His advance and retreat were like lines from a manual fed directly into his feet. "Stop blocking every blow," her brain told her. Her arm ignored her brain, and sparks glittered as Nibirius's sword clanked against the obsidian glass of her defending knuckle knives. The force of the blow reverberated up Gideon's arm and shuddered into her spine. Her sword sang forward in what she knew to be a perfect thrust, aimed true and hard at his side. She heard an oily shink, and then another blow quaked its way into her elbow and up to the base of her skull. The blade she had taken for a dagger had separated into three, trapping hers neatly, a trident knife, which was so hopelessly obvious that she probably had to offer to save time and kick her own ass for him. Nibirius smiled at her blandly. It was the most irritating fight she'd ever had. He wasn't as fast as she was, but he wasn't wearing robes, and anyway, he didn't have to be as fast as she was. He just had to keep her at arm's length, and he was a master at it. This, to the touch nonsense, was pissing her off. If she had been wielding her longsword, she would have simply smashed through him like a brick through a window pane. But she had a needle in one hand and a handful of black glass in the other, and had to skip and hop around like he was wielding poison. And he had been a cavalier probably since the day he was born. At some points, he could stand there completely still, completely bored, his sword held in perfect form as though he were doing dressage. The light beat down on her robes and her head. She couldn't believe she was being held at bay by someone who had eaten every cavalier manual and chewed dutifully 25 times. Nibirius toyed with her languidly. He had a trick where his sword licked out like a cat's claw, immediate, before pulling back again with a measured half-step. And he kept her at sword's length, never letting her enter his space. He kept up his litany of parry, quick attack for space, pressure the sword with the offhand, until she was sick to death of it. Gideon ran her rapier down the length of his, lightless black on silver, with a shrill squeal, but he circled it deftly down and away.
She thrust again, high, and found that the upper breadth of her blade was caught neatly within the fork of that goddamned trident knife. He used the leverage to push her down, down, and she found that his rapier was sliding forward over her arm through the tuck of her elbow. Aglamine had taught her to anticipate a death blow. She flinched to the side immediately, letting it press tight against her, swearing mentally all the way. In a real fight, he'd be able to slice a hot ribbon over her chest and shoulder, but couldn't kill her either way, and he couldn't touch her with the point, just the edge. She was still in the duel. But then he did something perfect. It was probably recorded in some shitty seventh-style swordplay book as Two Crows Drinking Water or The Boy Strangles the Goose. He pivoted her sword downward with his three-bladed knife, jerked the wrist of his rapier hand forward, and flicked the black blade of the ninth from her grip. It clattered to the worn-out flagstones and was still. Jean-Marie gulped off a yelp in the background. Her heart trickled like prayer beads sliding down a string. Nabirius stepped out of his lunge and smiled that irritating smile again. "You cut too much," he said. He did not smile when Gideon unwound her sword arm from his rapier in a swift wheel of movement, ducked forward and punched him in the solar plexus. The breath wheezed from his lungs like he was an open airlock. Nabirius crumpled backward, and she kicked her robes aside to touch one booted foot to the place beneath his knee. He staggered, spat, and fell. She dropped for her sword and backpedaled for space as he thrashed like a fallen animal trying to rise. Gideon fell into stance, raised her sword, and let it come to rest at his collarbone. "Match to the third," said Corona Beth, which startled her. Her sword was shrugged away. Nabirius, furious and wobbly, was finally up on both feet. "Babs," his princess said hurriedly, "are you all right?" He was coughing throatily. His face was a dark, velvety red as he sheathed his sword and squeezed down on his knife, causing some mechanism to snot the side blades back into place. When he bowed to her, it was amazingly scornful. Gideon slid her own sword back into her scabbard, somewhat discombobulated, and bowed in return. He tossed his head back haughtily and coughed again, which somewhat ruined the effect. "She's not some nonius come again, she's just a brawler," he said in throaty disgust. "Look, idiot, when I disarm you, match is over. You bow, all right? You don't keep going." The sharply dressed cohort cavalier said, "You let your guard down, Turn." "The match was over the moment I got her sword." "Yes," she said, "technically." "Technically?" He was getting even redder-faced now. "Everything's the technicals, and that's Prince Turn to you, Lieutenant. What are you playing at, Dias? I held her at bay the whole time. I won, and the cultist fouled the match. Admit it." "Yes," said Dias, who had relaxed into an arms-behind-the-back, at-ease position. It looked more at home in a military parade lineup than at an informal fitness match. She had a neat, mellifluous voice. "You won the bout. The ninth is the less able duelist. I say she is the better fighter. She fought to win. But ninth," she said, "he's right. You cut too much." The cavalier from the third looked like he was very close to violence. This, for some reason, had made his eyes bulge with sheer resentment. He looked as though he were about to unsheath his sword and demand a rematch, and backed down only when one golden arm was slung about his shoulders and he was pulled into a half-embrace from his necromancer. He submitted to a hair ruffle. Corona said, "The third showed its stuff, Babs. That's all I care about."
"It was a convincing win."
He sounded like a huffy child.
"You were brilliant. I wish Ianthe had seen you."
Jean-Marie had risen to stand. She was a brown, brick-like young thing, Gideon had noticed, seemingly all corners. Her eyes were alight, and her voice was piercing when she said,
"That's how I want to fight.
I don't want to spend all my time in showboats. I want to fight like a real cavalier, as though my life's on the line."
Nibiru's expression shuttered over again. His gaze met Gideon's briefly, and it was somewhere beyond hostile. It was contempt for an animal that had crapped indelicately in the corner. But before any more could be said, Magnus coughed lightly into his hand.
"Perhaps," he said, "we should fall to exercises, or paired work, or something that will make me feel like I'm practicing to be fighting fit. How about it? Sparring may be the meat of a fighter's training, but you've got to have some, well, vegetables and potatoes."
"Magnus, potatoes are a vegetable, Magnus."
Gideon stepped from the dais, unbuckling the knuckle knives from her wrist, easing her fingers out of the grips. She wondered what Iglamine would have thought of the fight. She almost wanted to see that disarm again. If Nibiru's hadn't looked at her like she had personally taken a whiz on his nicest jacket, she would have asked him about it. It was sleight of hand rather than brute force, and she had to admit that she'd never even thought about a defense, which was stupid. Some sixth sense made her look upward, beyond the skeleton still swabbing industriously at the glass door, out past the pit where centuries of old chemicals were being wiped away. In the aperture before the tiled room, a cloaked figure stood. Skull-painted, a veil pushed down to the neck, a hood obscuring the face. Gideon stood in the center of the training room, and for a second that emasculated minutes, she and Harrowhawk looked at each other. Then the Reverend Daughter turned in a dramatic swish of black and disappeared into the flickering vestibule.
Chapter 12.
"Excellent to have you with us," said Teacher one morning. "Excellent to see the night fitting in so well. How beautiful to have all the houses commingled."
Teacher was a fucking comedian. He often sat with Gideon if he caught her at table for later meals. He never showed up to breakfast. She suspected he had his much earlier than anyone else at Canaan House, with the jovial,
"I find vows of